This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
So I'm looking at the work of the National Viewers and Listeners Association. I'll say more on that in a moment. I'm working within the framework of a theory called moral panic theory, which arises from sociology, but has linguistic consequences. I'm looking at keywords and key keywords. And I'm also then at the end just exploring a discourse of moral panic. So that's generally what this talk is about. Let me just introduce the National Viewers and Listeners Association, though anybody of a certain age from the UK will need no introduction to them or to their chief leader, Murray Whitehouse, whatsoever. She was one of the most prominent media figures of the 1960s, 70s and 80s, and her pressure group was key in the introduction of quite a wide range of media censorship and regulation legislation in the UK. She founded and organised this organisation in the early 1960s in order to, in this quote-unquote, clean up TV. She wanted a whole range of things excluded from the media, not just TV as it happened, but that was her phrase. Also included cinema, book, print, etc. Now, the organisation sought to impose a set of beliefs rooted in conservative Christianity on the media at large. Now, that might sound as though it's me making a value judgment on what they were doing. It's actually their self-stated aim. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to roll things back to a time when things were clearly much more certain, there was a much more straightforward moral framework, and they were directly combating what they saw the moral relativism of the 1960s. So it was a sort of very much an ideological process that they were engaged in. It worked through lobbying and, on occasion, by bringing prosecutions. There were certain high-profile cases that they brought. Probably the most high-profile case was the last ever blasphemy case. Well, we haven't had another one. We could in principle. But they did bring the last ever successful blasphemy prosecution in the UK in the 1970s. So they were very, very active indeed. And as I said, if you say the words Murray Whitehouse to anybody of a certain age, she will instantly pop up in their mind and scold them for swearing or something like that. She was certainly a very popular figure. Okay. Now, I approach the work of Murray Whitehouse and try to think of it in terms of moral panic theory, not because I've thought that that might be the case. Lots of people have done that in a more qualitative paradigm. There's quite a bit of work done on interpreting their writings in the context of a moral panic. But what is a moral panic? Well, Stanley Cohen developed what is quite an influential sociological model, moral panic theory. Now, much has been written about these panics, but the origins and reasons for successes of particular panics remain somewhat unclear. But basically, a moral panic is some type of media hoo-ha, if you like, which blows up from time to time, in which a particular problem is fastened upon, blown out of all proportion, and then scapegoats are sought for it. So it's a model whereby society suddenly becomes interested in a particular thing, the media picks up on it, explodes it out of all proportion, and then the hunt for the witches begins. And Stanley Cohen did his original work, and again, people of a certain age in the UK will know all about this, looking at a moral panic that spread about mods and rockers in the early 1960s, taking over lovely old granny's seaside resorts and wrecking them, things like that. And if you think about media, both in the UK and beyond, you'll think of some of these moral panics. So they go around from time to time. We've just pretty much, I'd say, come to the end of one in the UK about refugees and funny foreigners. You know, these things do the rounds. But certainly, Murray Whitehouse tried to instigate them. But what can be difficult is explaining exactly how they work and exactly why some of them don't work. What sort of are the conditions in which the ground is right for a moral panic to be sown? Nobody's ever actually explored that. But one thing I've been doing is looking at moral panic theory in a slightly different way from a linguist's perspective. Now, Deborah Cameron, I should call her, I suppose, has looked at moral panic theory, but very much in the qualitative paradigm, looking at individual texts and analysing them quite closely. I've stood back from moral panic theory in part because of something that Cameron says, and try to think of whether or not we can have a general discourse model of a moral panic with roles in it which we can predict and observe. The observation that Cameron made that made me do this was she said that moral panic discourse is very often obsessive, alarmist, and there was another word which indicated frequency, but it's gone right out of my head. But anyway, obsessive, moralistic, and alarmist, that was it. Now, all of these words to me seem to indicate a lexical effect. You should be able to measure it within lexis. If it's obsessive, surely there's going to be a frequency-related impact. If it's moralistic, well, it will be selecting a certain type of lexis related to moralistic discourse. And alarmist, again, you'd expect certain words to be appearing in the text more frequently than they would have otherwise. So those three observations said to me, frequency, frequency, and frequency. There will be a difference in frequency between those texts and other texts. So I then started to think about the types of words or the types of role in a discourse that a moral panic would predict. And I've listed them out there. They'll be in the paper eventually, and in some ways they're not important. What I'm saying to you in the abstract is I think there are certain types of words also indicating certain parts of the structure of a moral panic that should be selected by the texts. So those moral panic texts will be selecting alarmist, moralistic words, obsessively discussing certain topics like asylum seekers or mods and rockers, depending on what the panic is. And we should be able to say, and that word relates to their obsession with finding scapegoats, or that word relates to their obsession with finding corrective actions, deport them all, something like that. So we'd see the word deport there all the time. So was it the case that we could move from a model like that via keywords and try to use keywords both as a diagnostic for a particular text to say whether it was or was not a moral panic, and also, in the way that Paul was doing, as a gateway to analysis. Now we've found these words, these are the things they were obsessing about, let's analyze these words. Well, in order to start doing that, I looked at three corpora. One, which was built by the inimitable Dan, who's here today for me, was what I call the Mary Whitehouse corpus, which was a corpus I built from her major writings over this period when she was most active, 1967 to 1977. We got three books, digitized them and edited them, and got them together into a corpus. So if you like, those are the thoughts of Chairman Whitehouse, all in one corpus. And that's about 200,000 words or so. I'll be very vague now so John can't criticize me. Obviously so vague I'll be beyond criticism. And then there was an interesting problem, and it's the first problem I'm going to look at in this analysis. What would I compare it against as a reference corpus? Ideally, of course, I'd have this lovely corpus, which was a proxy for general English, running from 1967 to 1977. It doesn't exist, and I wasn't inclined to build it, and indeed it would be very difficult to build it, because even now getting machine-readable texts from that period is difficult, especially things like newspapers, etc. And I think I had about 10p, which I paid down to build the Mary Whitehouse corpus from the faculty, so there wasn't any money there. So there was one corpus which existed beforehand, which was very good in terms of time frame, the Lobb corpus, 1,000,000 words from about 7 years before that time frame begins. And then, as we've heard this afternoon, the Flob corpus, which is quite some time after the corpus ends. So which one should I use? That presented me with my first problem. What I decided to do, in a way, was approach the problem in the same way as Mike was approaching the issue of how bad a reference corpus can you get away with, by starting to triangulate, using either one, and seeing if it actually introduced enormous differences into the keyword list which I was extracting. And as you can see from those results there, it didn't actually. Whether or not I used a corpus which was too early, slightly too early, or a corpus which was slightly too late, I was generally getting the same set of keywords flying out of there, which was quite encouraging for my idea that these texts would be so distinctive that they would throw up certain sets of words. If I used a text that was too early, it was throwing up these words. Text too late, it was throwing up these words. So irrespective of whether I used flob or lob, about 75% of the keywords which were generated were identical. So that was very useful for me indeed. But one thing I considered doing was saying, OK, I will only use the keywords which both flob and lob, therefore, say are keywords. I'll ignore the ones where there's some noise. That was one idea I toyed with. I didn't do that in the end for reasons that will become apparent shortly. So that was one issue. And again, as I said, it relates very much to the paper that Mike's given this afternoon. And again, like Mike, I didn't find it that big an issue in the end, or I couldn't see there being that big an issue between those two comparisons. The bigger problem for me is that even though I knocked up the p-value in Wordsmith as high as it would possibly go, trying, if you think back to this sort of microscope metaphor I've been using, to fine-tune down as low as I could go, just the keyest keywords possible, even with the top setting, I can't remember what it was, but I remember there were a hell of a lot of noughts after the point before the one in Wordsmith when you do that, I was still getting 150-plus keywords. Now, this text was very, very different from general English. Again, giving me some cause to hope that my prediction that frequency effects were being caused by the moralistic, alarmist, obsessive nature of the text. But in terms of me wanting not to feel like Satan at the Gulf, it wasn't really helping, because rather than just approaching the text, I was now having to think about going and looking at 150-plus keywords, going back and doing concordance and collocation, etc. So I felt like an 18-year-old again, and I wasn't too keen on doing the assignment. So I had to think of some other way, some way to improve the refinement of this zooming in yet further. Now, I could have done it by throwing 25% of the keywords away, but I wanted, because of the difference between lob and flob, but I wanted something even more fine-grained than that. And the solution I used was to use key keywords, which also allowed me to do some other things, as we'll see as well. And there I used a minimum keenness of at least 5 for that. Now, key keywords, that's just to give you an idea of the different words. This is what Mike was saying before about PowerPoint. You forget some of the slides. This one, I should have said, is actually taking all of the keywords and putting them into those moral panic categories that I'd created. And in doing that, I could see that pretty much as a diagnostic tool, it seemed to be working. Just by a quick look back in the concordance, I could see, for example, that when the word BBC, the first word in the scapegoat column, came up, Mary Whitehouse was complaining about it and saying they were causing moral decline in the nation. It was one of her scapegoats. She hated the BBC. Similarly, you get names like, let me think of one I can really remember, Lord Normanbrook, who was failing to regulate properly at the time, even though he was a regulator. So it seemed to work, but I didn't want to go in and examine each one of those in detail in order to actually explain things. I wanted this finer-grained approach, and key keywords it was. Using key keywords, where I'm looking for words which are not merely key in the whole corpus, but across subdivisions in the corpus. So it's key in each chapter, or at least 5 chapters in all of the books, I was able to screen out a lot of the keywords. You lose no keywords, but you do get that extra level of refinement. So she wasn't just obsessing about these things. She was obsessing about these things over several chapters, or over several books in this case. And it got it down to a nice, lazy undergraduate level of analysis for me to go and do. And that's about all I can manage these days. So I thought, great, I can look at these words. But again, as the diagnostic tool, it seemed to be working. It was quite easy for me to look at these words, concordance on these words, and slip them into one of my moral panic discourse categories, indicating to me that this might be a good way of saying, in some more scientific and less qualitative fashion, this is a moral panic discourse because it represents the key thumbprint, if you like, of a moral panic discourse. There are obsessive and frequent uses of certain types of words which can fit into these discourse roles. So, key keywords. Another nice thing that key keywords allows us to do is look at something that I call transience. Somebody's probably called it something else, and if they have, Mike, remind me of it. And I was interested in seeing across her body of writing how certain topics slipped in and out of focus in her writing. So we're seeing a word which is key perhaps in 3 chapters from the 50 chapters in all of her books, but not all of them. But then again, we may see other features which are key in all 50 chapters. So they're an obsessive and continuous discourse, as opposed to something which you might just pick on in one chapter where it's talked about so much it becomes key. So it can allow us in some way to see the drifts and turns of the rhetoric and the focuses of the rhetoric in the corpus. So these key keywords are key in subparts of the corpus, but not across the whole corpus. So if we then, and this also relates to something we said earlier today, in fact, I think I said it in response to David's paper, if we then set our settings on this boring metaphorical microscope, it's even boring me now, in different ways, we can get different views on the text which tell us different things. So, for example, in this case, with key keywords, I used two settings on this metaphorical microscope. One, looking for key keywords where I was using the books as the major division of the corpus. And secondly, looking at key keywords where I was using individual chapters as the subdivisions of the corpus. And you get slightly different results doing it that way. Looking over on the left, we have book-based key keywords only. These are words which, if you take the whole book into account, a whole book, are keywords in that book. So we see words like women, campaign, ITA, phone, school, da-da-da, etc. If you like, that's where the discussion over the length of a book becomes salient. At the other extreme, over on the right, we have words which are key only in individual chapters, when in fact I set a cutoff of three chapters. So only in groups of three chapters minimally, and not whole books at all. They never actually become key in an entire book, but within the book there are islands where the discussion is such that over two or three chapters they're talked about sufficiently that they become key in that island, that part of the book. So you have corruption, education, decency, listeners, abortion, sexuality, things like that, which come into focus and out of focus within one book. And then down the middle, you have a set of words which are talked about so frequently that whether or not you look at it with your book view or your chapter view switched on, these are key keywords. They're talked about fairly uniformly, obsessively throughout the book. So in any individual chapter or the book as a whole, you see it as a key keyword. So we can set, if you like, these two different views on the text, or however many different views on the text you want. You could have gone down to paragraph level, I suppose, if you wanted to. And see how, in fact, the, if you like, the spotlight of the discourse, the focus of it, is shifting between chapters and sometimes is on floodlight. The whole book is about women, or just this chapter is about decency. So it allows you to engage with the text on its different levels. Okay, so if I put this cutoff in, and if the computer comes back to life in a moment, going to work? Yes. Then I can shift from that and start to think of the analytical function of key keywords. So I have a way of looking at the text in different ways and seeing the sort of wandering of the rhetoric about it. I've played with the diagnostic feature of keywords and key keywords by fitting the keywords to my model and exploring my hypothesis that frequency is intimately related to moral panic and the categories of moral panic. But then we get back to the point which Paul departed from, where we go in and we try to analyse that lazy undergraduate subset of words that I'm left with out of the 220,000 I started with. There, I do things very similar to what Paul did. I use different analytical procedures on the words, looking for semantic fields, semantic prosodies, collocation, colligation, concordancing, playing around with the words and trying to pin them back to their context. How are they used? What is their ideological role in the text? How are things being represented through the use of this word? So here, I've just given you what I've done to the corrective action category in this analysis, and again, I'd agree with the previous speaker, my analysis is somewhat impressionistic over on the left there. These are just broad types of words that I can see appearing, and the key keywords over here. And then I can go in and analyse those further. So if I look, just say for example, at the words parents and responsible, I'll just go and look at those and explain how I see them going together in Mary Whitehouse's text. Now, there are two separate key keywords which occur in her writing. Parents, she talks about very frequently, and the word responsible occurs very frequently. But how are they related? In fact, when you look at how she uses those words, very often they come together. She's talking about the responsible, so the set of people who are responsible, or responsible parents, i.e. the subset of another group that actually matches responsibility. And what she's doing in that is quite interesting, and it's a process which is actually at the very core of the moral panic itself, in that she's specifying, if you like, a group of goodies and a group of baddies, which in sociological terms are called in-groups and out-groups. The in-group, in this case, are the responsible, and the responsible have subgroups within them. In this case, there's an overlap with the set of parents in the world. So the in-group are the responsible, and indeed the subset of the responsible who are parents. Now, without mentioning them or discussing them very much, this sets up a potential opposition with those parents who she deems are not responsible, i.e. irresponsible parents. But as Stuart Hall, I think, predicts, as is often the case in representations like this, they emphasise and determine one group, the goodies, if you like, and spell out their attributes, and imply, therefore, the out-group and their attributes without explicitly spelling them out. So within the text, you'll find much discussion of good parents, and you start to see the features of good parenthood picked out in the text. Similarly, you see the responsible in the text, and you see the features of responsibility picked out. And you infer, therefore, that the negation of responsibility is the negation of the features associated with it. To give an idea of how this works, here are just four examples from the corpus. The campaign is regarded as the expression of the will of serious and responsible people. So responsible people are serious people. Modulated voices of reasonable opinion. The reasonable have modulated voices. They're not the people who are standing and shouting and swearing. They're the reasonable middle class ones. That every responsible Christian viewpoint is given a fair expression. Of those responsible people who worked so hard and selflessly for its original aims. So these responsible people work hard, they're selfless, etc. So you slowly start to see the in-group constructed, and by consequence you start to imply the out-group. These people, you could say, who are not a Christian, who don't have modulated voices, who you would regard as not being serious, who don't work hard, who don't work selflessly. This starts to characterise that set of people, A, who aren't responsible, but B, because in the text responsible opinion and responsible people are identified with her position, it also starts to mean that if you don't agree with me, you can't be responsible, and no matter how modulated, therefore, you think your voice is, you're probably not one of these people. You begin associated with the out-group itself. So there's this subversion, if you like, of the concept of responsibility and its overlap with parenting in the text, which you can start to see. Now, that's just a way in to analyse the text through a theoretical model, making it the slave of frequency, and then returning through frequency to the qualitative analysis to explore how the individual roles in that model of discourse that one has hypothesised begins to work out. Rather than simply saying, I'm going to look at one text, and on the basis of this one text and my reading of it, I'm going to hypothesise these roles, etc., we can use the corpus data and keywords in this case in order to make predictions about the types of things we should see in texts of this sort, diagnose whether we're seeing texts of this sort if we accept that diagnostic technique, and then get windows into the analysis of the text, but windows in through the theory and the predictions of the theory. So I'm not just looking at the word parent, I'm looking at the word parent which, according to the theoretical model I'm looking at, is being used as a corrective action, in my opinion here. Does the data support it? So there is a marriage there between theory, corpus data, and frequency, and also quantitative and qualitative analysis, which might allow us to actually... I won't say that because that sounds rude. Which might allow us to put more flesh on the bones of the analyses that we're undertaking and carry them out on a much larger scale than we would be able to if we were simply doing hand and eye analyses. And also, I think, claim some objectivity for the analyses that we were undertaking. There's still elements of subjectivity in this analysis, but I would argue that it's fundamentally less subjective than me approaching the text and saying, I think she constructs parents as scapegoats or whatever, and therefore that's how I will analyse the rest of the text. The text is informing the membership of the elements of the model rather than me dictating them in this case. So that's another way I think keywords can work. I think that went faster than I intended it to. Anyway, I shall stop and we'll move on to the next talk, I think.